Welcome to the Payments Journal podcast. And here is your host, Ryan Mack.
Welcome to the Payments Journal podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Mack. Now, let's talk about omnichannel. Consumers love it, and quite frankly, they demand it. But where consumers go, so often do fraudsters go as well. So, with that being said, how do organizations protect themselves and their customers from fraudsters who target merchants who have implemented an omnichannel experience? Well, to unpack that question and more, I'm joined by Jonathan McGrandle and Dave Sensi from New Data Security and Tim Sloan from Mercator Advisor Group. So there's certainly a lot of data and insight to unpack on today's episode, so without any further delays, let's start the show.
So Jonathan, Dave, Tim, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on today's episode where we're really going to be taking a look at the fact that consumers are really demanding a hybrid online-offline experiences amid more of kind of some of these creative tacks that we're certainly seeing going on within the payments industry. Now, Jonathan, I'd like to start off today's conversation with you because I think that your organization has some really fascinating statistics kind of really surrounding all of this. So maybe you could unpack those for our audience and maybe put a little bit of a context to them as well.
Sure, absolutely. So I guess maybe the first kind of stat that we observed across New Data was that account openings kind of decreased by 15%, and that's year over year, so from 2020 to 2021. Now, at face value, that stat might be a little bit of alarming. You know, you might expect that account openings continue to increase as more people go online. But the thing to keep in mind here, of course, is that the COVID pandemic really took off in that first half of 2020. So lots of people were kind of jumping online for maybe the first time ever, or maybe the first time with a specific merchant. So while that number has come down, it might not necessarily be all that too surprising. And that 15% number is also very specific to account openings. Across e-com purchases in general, we've actually seen a 51% increase. And so account openings have come down, but actual online activity has really taken off, almost to the point where, you know, we've kind of reached this peak of online consumer maturity. People are all online, they're registered, and now they're really starting to take advantage of that. They're really going in there, making purchases, making transactions, really interacting with merchants and their accounts. The other thing that we've seen across New Data is an increase in kind of hybrid shopping experiences. So an example of this is buy online, pick up in store. You do your online shopping, but you want it instantly. So you place the order and then it's ready for you in store a few hours later. And we're kind of expecting this growth to maintain around 15% year over year again. And not necessarily just in e-commerce, but MasterCard overall reports a 55% increase in restaurant spending and 60 plus percent increase for department and apparel stores. So pandemic is easing out, but definitely online activity and purchase activity in general is definitely at an all-time high.
Those are truly amazing statistics. I know in our household, we concentrated our purchases during COVID on the trusted merchants that we already had relationships with. And so while I can understand from our perspective that there was a 15% decrease, it actually does kind of surprise me that people weren't out looking for items that they couldn't fulfill through their traditional merchants, that they weren't looking at additional merchants to try to get them. But that buying online, pick up in store, we've seen exactly the same huge trend. Its growth has been astounding.
And of course, why not? I mean, it's such an easy experience to take advantage of.
You bet.
Yeah, now I certainly find that to be very interesting. And Dave, I want to loop you into this conversation here because the report that Jonathan was kind of unpacking there talks about the trends post easing of restrictions. Now, what about tax threats? Are fraudsters also reaching quote unquote maturity?
I appreciate the question, Ryan. And building off of what Tim and Jonathan just talked about, if you think about, as Tim said, he started with those established merchants that he trusted. There was a lot of merchants that really didn't operate in the online space during the height of COVID and the restrictions and small businesses shutting down. So they had to quickly adjust to create an online presence. A very basic example I like to give is a liquor store. Majority of the time, people would go in and just pick those items up in person. Well, they shifted to an online presence, a buy online, pick up in store, or pick up on the curb. So now they were operating in this new world. So you had to create accounts for these websites and merchants that purely just didn't operate in the space historically. So now that those people have created those accounts on these merchants that entered the space, there's no need to create those accounts anymore because most of them are already established, operating in the new world that we live in. But getting to your question specifically, Ryan, about the maturity of fraud, are we seeing a similar maturity, same that we're seeing in the e-commerce space? I don't know if I'd say that fraudsters are actually reaching a maturity. I would certainly say that merchants saw the increase of online activity due to, like I said, having to shift to this new environment or just getting a lot of traffic because Tim was trying to buy everything online. But certainly merchants took measures to increase their fraud protection by blocking some of these very basic, unsophisticated attacks. Ironically, actually, new data in the first half of 2020 saw a 54% increase in card cycling attempts. So that's someone writing a very basic script to test card credentials at a checkout page to see which ones are accurate and which ones aren't. Now, those are very unsophisticated attacks. But additionally, fraudsters had to adapt and add more tools to adjust to make these attacks, these more sophisticated attacks, look more genuine. So examples would be like changing their automation strategies to make it look more human-like, whether that's spoofing a device, whether that's imitating human keystrokes or mouse movements, whether that's if you get hit with a CAPTCHA and then you actually farm it out to a CAPTCHA website to have a real human complete the CAPTCHA. So I don't know if I would necessarily say that it's reaching a maturity. What I would say that is that the fraudsters are adapting, just like that the merchants are adapting online. And there's different techniques that fraudsters are using to make their attacks look more genuine. And I think this trend is going to continue. So as the fraud prevention tools get better at identifying these types of attacks, the fraudsters are also going to have to shift to make their attacks appear less obvious. So just like fraudsters are having to adjust their fraud strategies and the ways that they attack, our fraud prevention methodologies are going to do the same. So I don't know if I'd say that fraudsters are getting mature to the way that they're attacking. I'm just saying that they're adapting to the same way that merchants are adapting to mitigate this fraud.
That's so true, Dave. I mean, one thing we've seen is that the fraudsters are extremely creative in changing their tactics, in broadcasting a tactic that worked to share that with other fraudsters, to applying new tools, new machine learning tools to their attacks. I don't think you can ever expect that they're done. They will continue to attack at a broad scale. And I think they also attack at a very narrow field. That is, they look for a specific e-commerce provider, platform provider, and they then start probing that platform and look for that platform across different merchants so that they can try to break in. They're very sophisticated in how they try to take our money.
Yeah, Tim, and building off of that, so we do the exact same thing, right? So if we see a new attack pattern emerge on one of our merchants that leverage new data, we're going to look for those same attacks across our ecosystem of clients. So if there is a new threat emerging, we can prepare for it across all of our merchants or all of our customers to ensure that we're ready to stop it. So as they get more sophisticated or come up with a new type of attack, we're ready to stop it across our ecosystem and not just at a single point solution.
Yeah, I've seen also the depth that your analysis goes to be able to understand the type of attack that's taking place. It's truly amazing.
Yeah, because I mean, when I'm listening to this, really what it's bringing to my mind is kind of almost the key word, because that's how kind of my mind will think sometimes, is really then the network effect for that. Dave, as you were pointing out, if, hey, we're able to see a merchant is under a certain type of attack, we're able to learn from that and then distribute it throughout the rest of the network. So that way then other merchants can kind of learn from that behavior and then aren't susceptible to that type of attack. And as both you and Tim were talking about, just the level of sophistication of fraudsters is something that, quite frankly, I kind of get a little bit amazed about, because it is certainly very much that cat and mouse game of, okay, let's try this attack. Did it work? And then, okay, let's just maybe modify it or shift it just a little bit or just enough maybe to throw off the system or to better understand how that fraud prevention system works on it. So Jonathan, really kind of keeping that in mind, we certainly know, and I think Dave kind of alluded to this, that there are some scripted attacks, and they are certainly getting better at imitating user behavior, such as pretending like they're typing, loading a page before submitting any information. Maybe you could kind of put a finer scope around this, and maybe you can tell us about those type of attacks that you were talking about in that last report.
Yeah, definitely. So in that last report, the second half of 2020, we spent some time to really focus in on some of those sophisticated attacks, as we termed them. And they were definitely increasing at the tail end of 2020 there, and they continue to increase in 2021. For this report, so the first half of 2021, we analyzed six different kind of industries, and these sophisticated attacks really led the way in four of those industries. And Dave touched on it a bit, so I'll just elaborate a tad here, but these sophisticated attacks are actually going to take the time and make the effort to spoof their device. So that might mean using IP addresses that come from legitimate carriers, making sure that the time zone of the device aligns with the IP address, and simple things like that, that as legitimate users, we never really think about, but as a fraudster, they do actually have to put a little bit of investment in just to make sure that everything aligns when you look at the broader picture. So spoofing their device, imitating mouse clicks and keystrokes, introducing variable timing across that type of behavior. And Dave also mentioned pulling human users in for key moments in the user experience. And what I mean by that is if you're a merchant and you present a CAPTCHA or a reCAPTCHA image to suspected fraud, what we've seen is that these sophisticated attacks will quickly take that image, send it off to a human user somewhere, a human service. That human service will answer the CAPTCHA, send it back, and it kind of thwarts the merchant's attempt at mitigating this fraud. And it's so seamlessly implemented within the fraudster's automation strategy. Of course, CAPTCHA is kind of the simple example there, but obviously we've seen an increase in social engineering as well. We touched on the concept of an online consumer maturity. So more people are online and more people are taking advantage of the online experience. And so naturally that presents a bigger opportunity for fraudsters to come in with their social engineering attempts. Our grandparents who perhaps weren't shopping online before are shopping online now. And so fraudsters are out there trying to take advantage of that. And finally, I'll say, Ryan, you kind of touched on the network effect there. So while we see these increase of sophisticated attacks, as a merchant, you certainly don't want to be reactive to this situation. If you haven't seen it yet, it's only a matter of time until you do see it. And so you want to take advantage of some of the learnings within the industry. Things like looking at behavior just beyond simple mouse clicks and keystrokes, but actually comparing that to the history of the account and previous behavioral interactions from that user. Taking the account history and putting it into context. So if the user is spending $100 on your site right now, is that within their typical averages, or does something look a little amiss there? And really looking at population behaviors. So leveraging your confirmed fraud, you can start to break out behaviors and device patterns between your legitimate users and those that you've confirmed as fraudulent. And there's going to be trends within those two subpopulations that perhaps you can leverage for some of these sophisticated attacks.
The use of behavioral analytics, both on the device as well as across the website, is certainly a new tool in order to prevent fraud. And you guys are in the lead on that.
Yeah, I mean, merchants and organizations in the past have definitely used device a lot. And device was for a long period of time something that was reliable and something that was accurate. But as fraudsters put in these investments, they are now easily thwarting some of those device identification strategies. But again, the thing to keep in mind is, as a legitimate consumer, I'm not typically making these steps to spoof my device or mask my device. And so merchants can use that to recognize me and improve my user experience. Whereas a fraudster's device who's been spoofed and is seemingly appearing in the merchant environment for the first time, that's going to be a little bit riskier just because there's no established history with it. So shifting your device strategy and introducing behavior, definitely two strong ways to combat some of these sophisticated attacks.
Yeah, I saw where the fraudsters had been using virtual machines so that they could have 80, 100 virtual machines all set up with different screen depths and memory sizes and CPUs to try to mimic different device configurations. It's amazing how sophisticated they've become.
Yeah, and Jonathan, you know, one of the things I thought was really interesting that you brought up was just the investment that fraudsters have put in. And really kind of when I hear that word, my mind kind of then jumps to all of the data breaches that we've certainly seen. And I know that Tim has quite frequently talked about in terms of just the amount of information that's out there and available on the dark web, and that's for sale. And I think then that kind of leads us to that the quality of data that fraudsters have is certainly getting better. But Dave, maybe you could kind of explain a little bit further around that in terms of just what you're seeing from your end at New Data of how it is that some of these fraudsters are using this better quality of data, and what does that really mean to the rest of the industry at large?
Thanks for that question, Ryan. So we actually saw an interesting trend in the first half of 2021 as it relates to better quality of data being available. So to put this in perspective before I dive into it, on average in 2020, we saw roughly 2% of the time in attack at a login placement that the credentials were accurate. What that means is when a fraudster writes a script of all those usernames and passwords that they bought on the dark web, 2% of the time the usernames and passwords are accurate. That doesn't necessarily mean that they get into the account. We still identify that it's fraud, but we get a signal back from our clients that the information was accurate. So usually that's about 2%. In the first half of 2021, we actually saw it jump up to 10%. So what that tells us is that the quality of credentials are much higher. So we did some speculation and analysis on our side specific to this and did a case study on this this higher percentage of accurate credentials that we were seeing at login. In one specific case study that we did in the first half of 2020 in our report, is we saw an attack with tens of thousands of usernames and passwords hitting the login page, and it had a 40% success rate. So we kind of stood back and we wanted to understand that and unpack what was actually happening. So to put that in perspective, when a genuine user logs in, they get their username and password correct 70 to 90% of the time. So as I said, normally in a normal attack, their success rate's about 2%. So 2% for attacks, scripted attacks, genuine user 70 to 90%. We saw 10% in the first half of 2021, and in this specific case study, it jumped up to 40%. So as we kind of step back and say, well, what may cause that? Does it actually mean that there's better quality usernames and passwords available because of breaches? Well, not necessarily. So what fraudsters are doing is, as we talked about during today's podcast, is they're getting much more sophisticated. They're taking the data that they buy, they're going to the forgot password page. They're writing a script of all those usernames and passwords and finding out which one of them are genuine. So sometimes you'll get a response that says, this account does not exist. So that's an indicator to the fraudsters that they can get rid of that username because it's not going to work at the login page. So they take these tens of thousands of accounts, run it against forgot password, then they're left with a subset. What they then do is then go create accounts. So they create all these fake accounts with usernames and passwords that they make up, and then they plug that into their list. So what they're left when they go into the login page to test all these usernames and passwords are a large portion of usernames that they know exist on the account because they already did a test on the forgot password page. These hundreds or thousands of accounts that they just created, and they run them all against the login page. Now you may question, well, why would a fraudster create all these fake accounts that they know are gonna work and then run them up against the login page? That's because it increases their success rate when doing an attack at the login page, because they know that some merchants put mitigations in place to identify low success rates. So you may put a simple block that says, hey, if a success rate at my login page is lower than X, flag this as a bad actor. So if they get it as high as 40% or higher, knowing that the average human is 70 to 90% and a normal attack is 2%, this may increase their ability to get in and look more like a genuine user. Now, we were able to block all of these attacks, but these are some of the more sophisticated attacks that the fraudsters are taking to look more genuine and get into the accounts. And what's really interesting is we've seen a variety of reasons why fraudsters would create fake accounts or shelled accounts. It's usually because there's a policy in place on a merchant website that says like one item per account. Like maybe there's a new console, a gaming console coming out. It's like, hey, one per address, one per account. So what these fraudsters will do is months before the launch, they'll create all these accounts. They'll age them because some merchants also look at how long has this person been a user on my platform. And then when this new item launches, they'll be able to use all these aged or shell accounts to complete a transaction. So it's quite interesting to see this new sophistication of they don't necessarily want to age this account. They just want to use the account at the login page to increase their success rate of when they're testing thousands of other usernames and passwords. So they know that they can get past some of these simple fraud mitigation tactics that merchants use.
No, Dave and Tim, I certainly have to agree that I think it is certainly very scary and enlightening of just the level of sophistication that fraudsters have gotten to here. And I think then it kind of brings up to the fact that we're starting to hear that merchants are almost kind of throwing their hands up to some degree here, and that more and more merchants are assuming that fraud is just kind of a cost of doing business. But I am curious, Jonathan, maybe to get your first opinions of this, you know, when we say something like that and we're kind of hearing that from merchants, what do you think about that in terms of just merchants kind of throwing their hands up and saying, well, fraud is just the cost of doing business?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one, of course. Everyone's goal is going to be to eliminate fraud completely, but in the absence of that, it's really key to just kind of manage the risk and find a level that every merchant is comfortable with. Each merchant is going to have varying comfort levels, and there's going to be a few considerations that they make when coming to a determination as to what their specific comfort level is. And the first kind of consideration is, what is the impact of a false positive, and what are the false positive rates associated with your fraud tools? And this is important because with our fraud strategies, there's always going to be this balance between catching fraud and introducing friction to your legitimate users. We can certainly stop all fraud, but it's going to have a great impact on your legitimate user experience. And the complete opposite of that is if we don't catch any fraud, then we can make sure that everyone has a very light, frictionless experience. We don't have to ask for credit card verifications. Heck, we don't even have to ask for passwords. We can just let people log into any account. But we're never going to catch fraud if we take that approach. So identifying what your false positive rates might be with your fraud strategy and what the impact of that false positive might be is going to be the first step in determining what your comfort level is going to be. And then also using fraud tools that consider multiple aspects are generally going to have a slightly lower false positive rate. We had that conversation a little bit earlier about looking at behavior and shifting the way that you use device. And so when you introduce multiple layers, you also introduce multiple kind of safety tripwires where if, say, your device strategy indicates that this is risk or is potential fraud, but you look at the contextual behavioral information and determine that this is, in fact, a legitimate transaction, you just saved yourself from a potential false positive. Fraudsters are going to have a similar viewpoint when they go about this, right? Fraudsters are ultimately seeking for a return of their investment. Ideally, for them, minimal investment, maximum returns. So from a merchant or from a company perspective, you know, the way that you can think about this is, how can you ensure that fraudsters need to put in maximum investment, and how can you minimize their returns? And so on the first front, on the investment front, you know, introducing fraud tools that take a multi-layered approach, really forcing fraudsters to put in that investment to mock those keystrokes or spoof their device. Every little effort that we make means that the fraudster has to put in more of an investment. And so it makes your application a little less suitable for them. And then also taking a look at how you can minimize the fraudster's returns. So a classic merchant who has a great user experience, they might have saved credit cards for an account. They might have saved loyalty points or saved gift cards. All of those things, just especially when combined, are this fantastic gift basket for a fraudster. If they can compromise the account, they have so many benefits that they can choose from. ultimately, kind of overall, you know, we really just need to find that balance between that risk management and that user experience. And I think the best way to go about that is to really use fraud tools that have a multi-layered approach, because you are going to naturally have a slightly lower false positive rate, and that allows you to really increase the user experience for all of your legitimate consumers.
I think you're right about the risk-based, right? If you're in a high-margin, low-cost business, you can have a different kind of set of parameters around that fraud management. If you're a high-value, low-margin business, you're really going to have to crack it down in order to keep your prices at a reasonable level. And you've got the tools that can do it either way.
Excellent. Yeah, Jonathan, you know, I certainly think that it was certainly fantastic where you brought up there in terms of kind of almost minimizing a fraudster's ROI here. Because when you take a look at the fraud landscape, I mean, it really is, it's a business at that point to them. You know, they are looking for a return on that investment, whether they invested in credentials or whatever the fact may be. And finding ways for your organization to be able to reduce that return is going to increase your likelihood that a fraudster is not going to want to make the investment to try to attack your organization to get that return on investment that they're looking for. So with that being said, Jonathan, Dave, Tim, thank you so much for taking the time today for talking to me about fraud and your new H1 report. And I hope to have you all back on the podcast real soon.
Thanks, Ryan. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks, Jonathan.